Senate State Affairs, please come to order. It is 9:01 a.m. on Tuesday, March 15, 2016. We have with us Senator Huggins, myself Stoltz, and Vice Chair Senator Coghill. We expect to be joined by one of the sponsors of the bill, who will be the first presenter. We have three measures up today. HCR 16, we're just going to adopt the CS, hopefully, and then set it aside for a future, and we're joined by Senator McGuire, and have future hearings on that bill. It's to addressing, it's not trying to, not hoping to make a self-fulfilling prophecy, but how to address any potential special session in the best interest of Alaskans. So that's our intent today, to have three measures, HCR 16, which we will not take action on. We're going to have presentations. It will be the final presentations in this committee for Senate Bill 114, Senate Bill 128. A couple of amendments will be laid on the table, and we're going to come back this evening for hopefully a very quick meeting. To I wanted folks to have time to look at all the amendments, and just I don't want to rush deliberation on some of them are very substantive and certainly change the fabric of the bill. So I want the decisions to at least have a few hours of contemplation and looking at the bills, and give the sponsors a chance to talk about them, and the sponsors of the bills to fend them off if necessary, they're part of our process, or to how they could be made. Anyway, it's part of the process. So we've already gaveled in. We're going to take up SCR 16. Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that CS for Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 16, State Affairs Version Whiskey, be brought before the committee.
And I'll object just to briefly describe this. I introduced this at the end of the last session. It's anticipating the possibility, or actually the inevitability of a special session last year. It was at and with the construction going on in this building, how to minimize increased costs to the states. Anytime you slow down a job, you're adding costs, and there's certainly provisions of this building contract that performance clauses. I don't want the state, right, for political reasons, forcing us to stay in here during a construction season when we can potentially take this any possible special session onto the road system. It only deals with the last part of this second session of the 29th legislature. It's a resolution. The governor, one of the reasons I did it as a resolution is the governor has said he would veto, and I guess there was a rumor that I was thinking about a capital or a legislative move. He said he'd veto it. So you can't veto a concurrent resolution. So this is a way we can express our constituents' point of view. So we wanted to lay it on the table. I don't want anything that raises such emotions, brings Kevin Jardell in on behalf of the city of Juneau, to not be rushed through. So we want to lay this on the table. With that, I am removing my objection, and I did accomplish my goal. I'm doing this in 3 minutes or less. So I'll remove my objection, and the committee substitute, as previously moved, is adopted and set aside for a hearing in the near future. Next bill before us is Senate Bill 114. We'll take just a brief at ease. I think the sponsors conferring with staff will be right back. Senate State Affairs back for a brief at ease. We have before us a committee substitute, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent that we bring version U, committee substitute for the sponsor substitute for Senate Bill Number 114 before us as our working draft.
I'm going to object so the staff can present the and in concert with you. The Senate State Affairs Committee staff and through our process, we've made one revision to the bill. Otherwise, it's the chairman's bill. You've primarily developed the CS, just for the record. So that's why we want to explain our provision, a revenue limitation. And it's our best first effort at it. And I know it's going to be evolving, but it leaves a placeholder of a discussion point. How do you get there? So with that objection, Mr. Brzezinski. That's why I call him Brandon most of the time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Brandon Brzezinski, staff to Senator Stoltz. Mr. Chairman, as explained, the Senate State Affairs Committee made only one change aside from the sponsor's changes. You'll find the committee's change on page 2, starting on line 28. Page 2, line 28, through page 3 to line 2. And as the chairman explained, we are establishing a revenue limit based on production tax and royalties that exceed $1 billion. For every dollar of production tax and royalty that exceed $1 billion, the annual PLMV draw will be reduced on a dollar-for-dollar basis.
Very good. Any questions? Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah. Maybe you could explain how, in practical terms, how that what the impact would be if you had, say, $2 billion in increased production.
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, if the state were to have received $2 billion in production tax and royalties, you would reduce your PLMV draw by $1 billion. So it's anything over $1 billion, the annual PLMV draw is reduced on a dollar-for-dollar basis.
Okay. Yes, this is just our starting point. It's the concept, though, can be fleshed out in the Finance Committee, but we've put something on the table. The thought was on my part, and as we've talked about different ways, spending limits themselves are really tough to implement, and we've seen from other action you can do previous year appropriations, and there's a lot of ways to, I don't want to be pejorative, but to alter the effectiveness of a spending limit. And this is, if all the prognostications are wrong and oil rebounds, and this was was still in place, we don't want to put a mechanism that would cause the ability to spend. Government has an intrinsic tendency to spend available money, and that was the. And this is. I know the sponsor's intent is sustainability and the long-term future. And this was just one small tool. Whether it's the right mechanism, that'll be determined through the deliberations. But it's my best effort to try to make sure that we don't get in a situation where the we end up increasing spending and then oil drops again. Where is our firewall of savings? We've spent savings for an accelerated government, or at least I think history will show that's a likelihood. So that's our with that. Any other questions for Mr. Brzezinski or me? With that, I think you're off the seat, and welcome Mr. Logan from your staff. Appreciate this has been a moving target getting this ready. I appreciate that you're ready to go, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jesse Logan, staff to Senator McGuire. The CS you have before you has four major changes, one of which has already been discussed, a revenue limit in Section 3. The other three changes, the first one is also in Section 3, and it changes the amount of the POMV draw from 5% to 4.5%. We did this for a few small reasons, mostly for long-term sustainability of the ERA itself. A 4.5% POMV draw squeezes the ERA less. It allows for a larger rate of growth for the permanent fund in general. And over time, we think that it will produce greater payouts. And we have modeled this with legislative finance, and they agree with that approach. The next change there is in Section 5, page 3. So I believe it's line 20 to 23, and this is an inflation-proofing mechanism. It's very similar to the governor's bill in that if the POMV draw from the previous year is multiplied by 4, the difference in the ERA would be could be returned to the corpus. So if you have 4 times the amount of your sustainable draw, then you can inflation-proof through this mechanism. The third major change, I guess, is in Section 7. It's page 4, line 23 through 31. And this is a review period. It allows the Commissioner of Revenue to consult with the Permanent Fund Corporation to look at the assets available in the ERA and recommend any adjustments to the percentage to the dividend or to the general fund. It also directs the Commissioner of Revenue to provide an annual report to the legislature in consultation with the Permanent Fund Corporation to evaluate the sufficiency of the assets within the ERA. There are several other small changes, and I believe you have before you, Mr. Chairman, a summary of changes document. The rest of those changes are mostly housekeeping measures that were done for cash flow and timing reasons in consultation with the Permanent Fund Corporation.
And I believe all these are for the general public or posted on BASIS. Did you have any other?
No further remarks, sir.
Okay. Senator McGuire?
No.
Almost too easy.
Yep. No further remarks. We've been working closely with you, sir.
I just want to make sure if any. We're going to have the governor's folks come up and present. I think we'll have enough time then for you to make any comments as well. So, well, you've reserved some time there. So.
That's fine. I really don't, Mr. Chairman, I really don't have many comments. I've already, explained the basis for 114. The amendments today are a result of consultation with members in both the House and the Senate who have been actively talking with their neighbors and also providing feedback from public testimony offered in this committee. So we're, through your amendment, adding a limit on spending. That's a concern people had, that if you are going to restructure the dividend, would the legislature go on a spending spree at some later point? We're trying to make it more sustainable by going from 5 to 4.5%. We believe the model inflation proofs itself because of the percentage of market value approach and the fact that we retain the constitutional requirement of having 25% of the royalties continue to go into the corpus of the permanent fund itself, but we've added the additional provision for additional inflation proofing to reflect times of growth. And then, of course, the review period we think is something that lawmakers have asked for us to come back and revisit. I know you have an amendment dealing with it a slightly different way, but this at least sets the provisions in 114 up for review. And I think that's important because the bill guarantees a $1,000 dividend, and we want to be sure that's sustainable. We also want to be sure that the model works as we think it will. And the last point I'll make is that not only have we worked with you and all the members here to address their concerns, but we've worked very closely with the Permanent Fund Corporation and their director, Angela Rodell. One of the concerns I had in making any changes to the bill was that it had already been thoroughly vetted by the permanent fund trustees and their consultants. So we worked closely with her such that all of the amendments you see here have been fully vetted.
Very good. I appreciate that, getting on the record. That's one of the things we wanted to do in this presentation. And we still will reserve if you feel moved by anything that's said in the other one, that we'll reserve that time. And I think we'll just take this couple of minutes, and we have... we'll use it. Senator Coghill, you have an amendment, number one. You go ahead and just go ahead and move it, and I'll object so that you can just explain the basic precepts so the public can...
Does it show up as amendment number one or two?
Number two. I'm sorry.
And there's a replacement, so I move amendment number two.
And that's just 29-LS0883- /U.2 Gardner 315-16, given that we have a replacement. I'll object, and we'll just take a couple minutes and explain your concept.
So I'll go to the difference between what was passed out before the committee and what was passed out after. On the very bottom line there, line 22, instead of the difference between 85%, it was an amount equal to 85%. And the effect of that is what we're trying to get to is excluding the dividend payment from the billion-dollar cap. And so I can have Renita Moss explain that to some degree if you wish. The concept of this particular amendment is a really bit of a hybrid plan on the paying out of the dividend. And so it takes, instead of leaning the dividend primarily on the earnings of the royalties, rents, and leases, it blends it with earnings from the permanent fund, earnings from your royalties, and a small valuation from the CBR. And what it tries to do is create a formulation that says you'll take 15% of the 21% sum of the net income from the earnings reserve. You'll take 15% of the royalties, sales, and proceeds net shares of the oil and gas leases, and 2% of the market value of the constitutional budget reserve, blends them together in a formulation. And the effect of that is you, instead of guaranteeing a particular number, what you do is you set up a principle that says on the health of the state, we all do well. On when it's the state is not doing well, whether it's in the CBR, the earnings reserve, or the royalties, the people of Alaska get to feel the ebb and flow of the long-term and the short-term health of the economy of Alaska. And so I had David Teal do a modeling on it. And the numbers that we plugged in there, the 15, 15, and 2, still leave somewhere near about a $200 million gap in where we're at in our funding, probably very similar to where we're at under the original concept of the bill. But it puts the dividend based on that principle of a health rather than guaranteeing a number. And it then goes back to using the earnings of the permanent fund, which I just struggled with how do I deal with it. So I'm hoping people will be able to read both the concept, and I will make sure that all of the members get the modeling part from David Teal. I think that's really kind of the basic concept. There might be some technical challenges in this, in that it took me about four drafts. As you can see, even the last one coming in was how to make sure that it worked right in this bill. And so the concept is something that I'm offering at this point, and I will try to answer any questions I can on it. This is my only shot at it. And so that's the basic concept, Mr. Chairman.
And I'm going to look at it more till then. I'm not sure, but at the very least, this issue will be before it'll be on the table for the Finance Committee to look at. So, Senator McGuire?
Absolutely. And in the spirit of compromise and looking at things, I'd like to offer my name as a co-sponsor on the amendment, knowing it'll be set aside and we'll consider it going into the evening session. But just one suggestion, if there was time that was allowed, sure. Mr. Chairman, I'd love to have Renita and Jesse come up and briefly just add a few more minutes to this. They've been working closely together on it.
Well, we have time. That's
okay.
Very good. And
as they're coming forward, just to explain, Senator Coghill and I came to kind of a similar conclusion that in the list of the things that people are concerned about, as you know, there are some people that just fundamentally don't believe we ought to restructure the permanent fund, period. Okay, so that's that category. But of people who believe we should, there were a few little outlying concerns that we've addressed. We talked about the spending limit and the 4.5% sustainable draw, et cetera. This was one other one that was out there. Some people had a concern that the public would react poorly to the idea of creating a dividend that was based on future rents and royalties. I explained my rationale for why I'd like to, because I'd like the next generation of permanent fund dividend recipients to have a better and different understanding of where that money comes from, that it's a partnership with their family and those who are creating the economy. But Senator Coghill and others made a valid point. So Jesse went to work on it. Renita went to work on it. David Teal came in, just so that everybody understands on the record, it was a team approach to trying to get at the same idea of not filling the gap entirely, but sharing some with government, basic government services, and keeping a dividend. But in this case, Mr. Chairman, not creating a separate mechanism of paying a dividend out of future rents and royalties. And that might assuage some concerns that the public had. The one thing that we all know is there's a trust issue that we have to build up in trying to work toward getting Alaskans to believe in what we're doing. And I just didn't want that concern sitting out there that somehow we were trying to bait and switch and put more volatility on the public. Even though I guaranteed a $1,000 dividend, for some reason that one message wasn't sitting in. So I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent that I be shown as a co-sponsor.
No, that's so recorded. And I just put this 7 o'clock or so meeting on tonight. If there's a time earlier in the afternoon that folks can free up for a half hour or 40 minutes, we'll huddle with folks and try to see it. But I just want to be able to let the public know. We can post on basis. I'll end up recessing it. I just did 7 just as a safety, and I think we'll make the recess no later than 7 to be posted. I know we don't have session today. Maybe that'll nobody's on finance. So if we can do that, I wasn't trying to make everybody's life miserable, but that was just a default trying to when I knew everybody was available. Well, there's a few of us. There are few enough of us here. We can probably make that happen.
2:30 works for me, Mr. Chairman.
Me too.
Well,
anytime today works for me.
Okay. Well, we'll look. So, please re-identify yourselves and identify yourself.
For the record, Reneva Moss, staff to Senator Coghill. And perhaps my contribution would be just to clarify the second half of this amendment. Because 15% of the royalties were already in the computation, we wanted to make sure that it didn't reflect on the $1 billion cap. So this amendment removes the 15% of the royalties from the $1 billion cap. And just for the record, this is a whole new area for me, and I want to thank Jesse for shepherding me through this.
Mr. Logan.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, this is Jesse Logan, staff to Senator McGuire. I think that Senator Coghill did a very good job of explaining this. This amendment restructures the way we calculate a dividend payout, and it ties it to three basic things. The 15% value of the statutory net income of the earnings reserve ties the value of the dividends to the long-term health of the market. For the last 34 dividends, the dividend has been tied entirely to the value of the market. This starts to share some of the value of the market with the long-term and short-term fiscal health of the state. The 15% of the royalties that would be calculated in here is the short-term fiscal health of the state, and the 2% of the CBR value would be the long-term fiscal health of the state. So we have sort of a three-dimensional shared risk and shared benefit between the state and the people, the residents of Alaska.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate the explanation. Is it possible to run through the numbers of what they would be for, say, this FY16 and FY17? I don't know if you have those in there somewhere.
Sure. Thank you for the question.
For 1AB. Yeah, I'm looking at the chart and trying to understand it.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. The numbers, are you referring to the numbers in the dividends?
If I could, Mr. Chair, I think this past year we paid out around $1.4, $1.5 billion in total dividends, and I'm just trying to figure out if looking at the amendment, looking at 1A, how much would in FY16, FY17, and I know we're still estimating a little bit for FY17, but roughly how much we would get under the current plan versus how much we would get under this plan under 1A, 1B, and number 2.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Mikowski, according to the modeling done by David Teal, the permanent fund earnings from the ERA would equal $618 million.
Which part is that?
No, this is individual dividends.
Oh.
Are you looking? You're looking at this.
Well, I'm looking at the amendment. We're on amendment number 2, right? And so I'm trying to figure out what would be the amount.
Got it.
So it says from the earnings, it's talking about how we're going to calculate the dividend. And as I see it, there's three components to it. You've got 1A, 1B, and number 2.
Yep.
And I'm trying to figure out how much would we get from 1A, how much would we get from 1B, how much would we get from number 2, so that we can figure out what the total dividend would be. for, let's say FY16, because we know that number. I think it was 1.4, 1.5 billion. And then compare it to what it would have been if this were in place.
Through the chair, you're right, 1.4 billion was the payout for last year's dividend. This payout overall would be somewhere closer to 700 million. It would result in about $1,100 dividend in 2016. And the bill retains the $1,000 floor.
We can show you those through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. We can show you on the break the individual breakdowns. If I had a calculator, I could do it right now. But
that's fine. We do it on the break. I'm just trying to figure it out.
The rough numbers, $1,100 dividend and 718 million.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
And the way what we put together here did not anticipate the floor. It just anticipated a calculation based on the numbers. And so you'll see that it can, as we get into 2020, it goes, dips under $1,100, $1,000. And it, if you go follow this calculation out, based on the numbers we have today, and this is a revenue forecast, basically. So it ends up in 2023 under $1,000, probably somewhere around the $800 mark. So if you let it float on the actual value of what's going on in the state, you still, if you look at the upper left hand, you still see that you have it steadies out at $5 billion for UGF, and so. If you go above $5 billion UGF, then you have downward pressure. You still have to do that. But it also extends out the budget reserves at a steadier rate. And on the bottom right-hand side, you'll see the permanent fund balance continues to rise. So the way I contemplated it was without the floor. And my guess is the bill still retains the floor. And I would probably defer that to the Finance Committee on. My idea would stay with the principal, but I understand the floor.
One thing I'd like to add, Mr. Logan, and then Ms. Moss.
Thank you. If you look at, I believe what you have on your modeling is a four chart page. So in the upper left-hand corner is the total budget and then the sources of which it would be paid from. And you'll notice the budget in the black line takes a bump in FY17, and that's because under this model we're now considering the payout of the dividend is part of the overall budget, and that's the reason you see the rise there.
Ms. Moss.
For the record, Lenita Moss. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I can give you sections of the formula for an individual's permanent fund. The 15% earnings would account for $618. The royalties would account for $211, and the CBR would account for $298, for a total of $1,127.
Thank you.
Any other questions on this?
Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
By way of comparison, remind me how much the dividend would be under the bill as it's currently written versus this. So this would roughly be a $1,100 dividend in FY16, and yours would be?
And through the chair, on the modeling at 50, did we do it at the $50 forecast? It was 1,200 roughly.
Through the chair, Senator.
On the fall forecast.
In the way the bill is currently written, the 2016 dividend is held harmless, so it would have a status quo dividend of over $2,000. Then it would transition to a new formula. The option there to transition to a new formula, if we did it this year, would result in about $1,100 or $1,200 dividend. I can show you that modeling as well at a break.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, just going out into the future, and I finally understand these charts now. I was just trying to get oriented here. Going out into the future, I see there's a slightly dipping dividend. It goes down to a little bit below $1,000 as we move out in future years. And as you move out into future years, into, say, 2025, are your dividend numbers higher, lower, about the same?
Through the chair, Senator, about the same, which is the reason that the $1,000 floor is retained.
Oh. Senator McGuire.
On that point, Senator Wilkowski, under the current bill as it's modeled, if you recall, it's a hypothetical because the dividend would have been based 75% of the royalties would have gone into a new fund. So the dividend could have gone as high as $3,000 or $4,000, depending on what the rents and royalties are into the future. And that's one argument for that model, is that there's risk, but there's reward, and that Alaskans would get the high end on that and not be sort of leveled off. This model is more stable, so it guarantees Alaskans a more stable share of the wealth, because it's coming off of the three components as opposed to just that future rent and royalty part. And I think that's the concern that some people in the public had, was if the state doesn't want that much volatility, why would the people in terms of their dividend? But the downside certainly is that in modeling, it's true, this bill currently holds the FY16 dividend harmless, but when we showed you the numbers under the fall forecast, it was about $1,200. So they're somewhat of a negligible difference between the dividend under this amendment or under the original bill. But modeling out to 2025, it was uncertain. We knew no matter what, it couldn't go below 1,000, but could go as high as 3 or 4.
Any other discussion on this amendment?
Just one other thing. Just to reiterate, the modeling that I have on this did not contemplate the floor. I just wanted to see what it looked like if you followed through based on this calculation. So.
So with that, we'll set this amendment aside until later today. With that, I am going to move amendment. It will be titled as amendment number 2, taking them out of order. Senator Huggins?
Yeah, stand by.
So, Mr. Chairman?
No, I've already moved. And that is 29-LS0883/U1, Gardner 31416. And it's it is the amendment dealing with the sunset. Senator Huggins?
Yeah, and I'll object for.
Thank you. This is. And I'm not certain about this amendment. I had, as many of you know in the committee, my preferred route was a public vote, putting this in the Constitution. This is trying to find some way to revisit this. It's a 2-year sunset, which is, with the extensions, is practically a 3-year sunset. As all sunsets, it's much more lengthier than its description, saying we're going to look at this again in 2 years. We have to, but by form, because we have to repeal and so forth. But the concept is to revisit this after, in this time of fiscal uncertainty, 2-3 years isn't a short time anymore, but would bring it back for discussion. It's not my first choice, but you deal within the parameters. And again, I, as much as anything, to put it on the table and to have this part of the record. Whatever happens with it, hopefully finance will also look at it and discuss the merits and the pros and cons of it. So that's as simple as that. With that, I will set aside this amendment for later in the day. With that, we'll set aside consideration of Senate Bill 114, which we will have our last hearing in the State Affairs Committee today on that sometime later today. So having eaten a few minutes into your time, we still have about 40 minutes for you, General Richards and Mr. Hoffbeck, and any folks you would like to bolster your presence. Pretty impressive duo as it is. I don't know what you could add to that. It's usually the hit comes after the compliments, but that's not coming today. Welcomes commissioners and Attorney General.
Mr. Chairman, Craig Richards, Attorney General, for the record.
Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner Revenue, for the record.
And for the record, we're dealing with Senate Bill 128, which is now before us.
Chairman Stoltz, members of the committee, I just want to make a few high-level comments before turning over to the Attorney General to work on a little bit more of the detailed considerations of SB 128. I think sometimes that we can get so lost in the weeds of the details of a particular bill that we kind of lose sight of what it was we were trying to accomplish in the first place. And for that, I truly thank this committee for the hearings that it's held on this bill and the effort put forward on this very critical topic. And especially thankful to Senator McGuire and the open, robust discussions that we've had really over the last year in trying to put together a plan that would create a sustainable and durable fiscal plan for the state of Alaska. I think early on in the discussions that we had over the summer and talking with the people of Alaska, one of the things that came out is very similar to what, Chairman, you made in your opening comments today, of the concern of...
About the legislature being held on the road system?
A little later than that.
Okay.
But just the idea of, you know, the people are concerned about the level of spending in government when we have high revenues, and that the importance of some kind of way to not control, but to I think have a kind of an accountability for the amount of money we spend in high revenue years, so that we aren't just chasing prices up and down and having to deal with a boom and bust within our economy. And I think the plans now are all starting to coalesce on that in one fashion or another. Everyone seems to recognize that has to be a part of the plan. I think one of the things that the Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act does that takes it even a step further is by encapsulating the volatility within the permanent fund by putting the oil and gas tax and royalty revenues into the permanent fund. We also create a secondary advantage, and that is to take out the lows within the system as well. I think one of the things that we've become keenly aware of this year in such this low oil price environment is the necessity to stress test these models at the extremes to make sure that they actually accomplish the goal even in times that are rare, but do occur. And so this model was tested very heavily, stress tested very heavily at a wide range of investment returns and oil price models so that to see whether in fact it could survive the highs and lows of a commodity based economy. And it did. It was run through a series of tests, thousands of iterations, and determined that we could actually draw sustainably $3.3 billion from our combined oil and gas revenues and investment returns on a sustained basis. And that's critical. One of the things that that we heard from particularly the private sector as we talked about this over the summer was the need to stabilize the government portion of the economic base of the state's economy. As much as we've tried to diversify the state's economy over the years, we primarily have two economic engines in the state of Alaska. One is, you know, the development of our resources, the commodity side of the equation, and the other is government spending, federal and state spending. There's very little we can do to stabilize the commodity side of the equation. We're a price taker. We're not a price maker. And so we are at the whims of the market on the commodity side of the equation. But the one thing that we can stabilize is the government spending side of the equation. And one of the things that the private sector told us very clearly was that they need that stability in order to be able to make long-term financial decisions and investments, that it's very difficult for them to make those long-term commitments when they're uncertain of what the spending levels are going to be in any given year and how stable the economy is going to be. So that's one of the reasons that we included that as part of our plan was the ability to try and take the lows out as well.
You've had a lot of discussions at your invitation with the business community. How would you counterbalance with the concern about the volatility of government spending and revenues? Is it a bit more concern about stability and making sure it's stable and isn't reduced, or if it's or if it's unsustainable. And we have some, certainly some sectors are dependent on a lot of government activity. Or how would you characterize that? Or is it, which many of us are hearing from our smaller business people about, they can't afford the level of government?
Chairman Schultz, I think both of those discussions come up. I think, the first reaction that we've gotten as we've talked around the state is the size of the government. I mean, that really has been kind of the price of admission for talking about anything else was, people needed to feel like they were only paying for the right size of government, that they weren't paying for excessive government. But underlying the discussion, particularly with the business community, was they needed predictability. They needed some kind of certainty at some level of the amount of the spending that was going to be coming out of the government sector. Because, frankly, it's a very large part of the economy of the state of Alaska. So I think it's both. But he says the first discussion was size, but then the second was almost equally important, or as equally important, was predictability and stability.
Predictability and stability are the most important parts, and that's impacting the largest revenue producers as well.
Correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, we had a little bit of fun, I think, debating the idea of whether a bad plan was better than no plan at all in one of the earlier hearings. But the reality is the Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act is not a bad plan. It's a good plan, and it's a plan that works. And it really isn't too complicated. It's not that hard to understand, but it does have a few extra parts in it simply because of the idea that we really did want to take that volatility component out of the system as part of the plan. I love the quote that Senator McGuire has on the bottom of her slides, I think from Einstein, and I'm going to misquote it, but the idea that you can't get out of a plan with the same type of problem with the same kind of thinking that got you into the problem. And the reality is we really do need to think about this differently. We need to think about it with a kind of a different dynamic, and we need to act now. The decisions in front of you, and we are very aware of the difficulty of the decisions that the legislature is facing with the plans that have been put forward. The administration can suggest, but we don't push the green button. We don't implement the plan. The legislature has to make those choices, and we recognize fully how difficult the choices are that are in front of you and the number and the significance of those choices. But the reality is it's not going to get any easier if we wait. Quite simply, big problems don't get easier by waiting, and just the opposite. They tend to get harder. The problems tend to grow. That's why it's critical that we feel it's critical to move this plan forward, get it to the Finance Committee so it can be reviewed in relationship to the other parts of the governor's fiscal plan, the new Sustainable Alaska Plan, the revenue components, as well as the cuts the government proposed and that both the House and Senate have modified and increased, so that this can be considered as part of the plan. And if we can reach the finish line with a sustainable plan for government spending, we'll just have done something that I think nobody really believed we could accomplish, and that was closing a $3.5 to $4 billion deficit in essentially a year and a half, in two legislative sessions. And we'll have done it in such a fashion that when it's all said and done, Alaska, the individual tax burden for people of the state of Alaska will still be one of the lowest in the nation, if not the lowest in the nation. We'll have protected a dividend. We'll pay a dividend that no other state pays. Our savings will continue to grow at least the rate of inflation, if not greater. Therefore, by protecting not only our children's future but our grandchildren's future, they will have the same opportunities that we have now. We've been able to preserve most of the government services that the people of Alaska have come to enjoy over the years, and that was one of the things that they said too, that people want to protect the essential services that government provides. And when we really tried to pin down what an essential service was, it was a service that I receive, right? But whatever services that a person receives is an essential government service, and those services are out there for a purpose. They weren't done. For no reason at all. They were done because there was demand for those services. And so we will be able to preserve the majority of those government services. And we'll still have money left to invest in development of our resources within the state of Alaska. Not at the level that we're currently investing, but still in hundreds of millions of dollars that would be available for resource development within the state of Alaska. As I said earlier, the Permanent Fund Protection Act is a good plan. It's a plan that works, and we simply feel that it's that we need to move it forward so that it can be considered with the rest of the new Sustainable Alaska Plan to develop this long-term fiscal stability for the state of Alaska. And with that, I will turn it over to Attorney General Richards.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioner. You took the long approach to describing, I think, about four, maybe five traits of what you're looking for. Could you just restate those in one, two, three, four, five traits?
At the end of what we're trying to preserve?
Right.
Yes, we're trying to keep the individual tax burden as low as possible on the people of the state of Alaska. We recognize that we're asking people to contribute more, but we're trying to keep it as low as we possibly can. We're trying to preserve the dividend. Again, it will be different than the dividend that's been paid in the past, but it will still be a substantial dividend and one that is sustainable into the future. We need to preserve the buying power of the corpus of the permanent fund. We want to make sure that we are not spending our future to preserve government now, our children, our grandchildren will have that same opportunity going forward. We want to retain as many of the essential government services as we possibly can. And then finally, we want to have money available to support development of our resources within the state of Alaska. And those are really the five components that we feel like the plan achieves.
Thank you.
General?
Thank you, Senator Coghill. I don't know if I'm supposed to say through the chair when the chair's not here. So.
And the chair is long as he's not here.
He becomes the chair, okay.
Well, the gavel.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Let's move some things.
This is a very abbreviated 8-slide presentation, a lot of material that you've seen before, but I wanted to hit the highlights of the Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act and the governor's plan. And in particular, I'll focus on some of the methodological differences between SB 114 and the conference substitute, just because I think bringing to relief the differences now is probably the most useful thing, given as the commissioners testified and I've heard Senator McGuire testify, that we're kind of getting a convergence of the ideas, that certainly the governor's plan borrowed some things from the senator's plan, now vice versa, and that's good, because that means we're developing consensus around some core ideas, but we're not there on everything, so I think that that's where the discussion's going to focus. So the very simple explanation of the governor's plan, it does really three things that is different than the status quo. The first thing is that we're placing the volatile petroleum revenues, production taxes, and royalties directly into the permanent fund. Right now, only a quarter of the royalties go into the permanent fund, and the rest go to the general fund. And historically, royalties and production taxes have been the two major revenue components to the state of Alaska upon which most of our budget was built. But as production has fallen and we're in a lower price environment, those revenues are obviously now no longer large enough to sustain the government. We're looking to tap the permanent fund. And I'll go into why in the next slide, why we're actually putting those volatile revenues into the fund itself rather than leaving them in the general fund. The next step of the governor's plan is that it draws directly out of the permanent fund to the general fund every year $3.3 billion. Effectively, what the plan does is it takes royalties, production taxes, and investment earnings of the permanent fund itself, and it turns all of those cash flow streams into an annuity. It essentially assigns a value to each of those cash flow streams, and just like with your own personal retirement account, it says, based upon reasoned actuarial thinking, this is how much you can draw in perpetuity each year from your savings based upon the revenue streams you expect. And this allows you to take the volatility and take it out of the general budget, put it in the permanent fund, and then take that steady cash flow. And then the final thing that the governor's plan does is it changes the dividend payout formulation from one based on five-year lag of half the earnings of the dividend permanent fund itself to a royalty formulation of half of royalties. So this is a slide.
Mr. General, Senator McGuire has maintained that her goal was not to fill the whole gap with the permanent fund earnings and dividend source and to make sure there are other decisions have to be made by the citizenry. How would you characterize
yours with a similar type vein of discussion.
Mr. Chairman, could you repeat that? I'm not sure I understood the question.
Well, did I characterize what you said correctly? It was Senator McGuire had stated earlier in her discussions that that her intent was not to fill the whole gap with the permanent fund earnings, but to provide a substantial portion, but it would leave the decisions to the process, whether you cut more or tax, or not to characterize your statements incorrectly, but not to have this, as you call it, the annuity and or the payout to make sure that other we don't become dependent just on the annuity or the payout as well. How would you respond to that and characterize how your the governor's plan would react in that similar manner, or how is it different, or how is it the same?
Mr. Chairman, so similar but a little different. Whether you're talking about using a PMOV approach or the senator's approach under SB 114, or you're talking about the governor's plan, you can't take enough out of the permanent fund to fully fund government.
Is that like the Saturday Night Live fest? You can't put too much water in the reactor? No, what is that? You can't take enough.
Well, like I said, even including the petroleum revenues, the governor's bill produces, as drafted, about $3.3 billion. Our budget is somewhere north of four.
So you wouldn't want to say you can't tax people enough and have that to be misinterpreted either.
So your question was whether or not we're leaving to the legislature, you know, the flexibility to budget how they want. And the answer really between the two is, between SB 114 and what the governor's plan is we're annuitizing two types of wealth, whereas SB 114 annuitizes one type of wealth, right? What SB 114 does is it takes a measure of the value of the permanent fund. It doesn't take the earnings of the permanent fund, the actual cash flow. It takes a measured value, and it turns that into an annuity that says you can take X amount out of the permanent fund every year. But then it leaves the volatility in the petroleum revenues. It's removing the volatility of the earnings of the permanent fund by using a market-based value approach, but it's leaving the volatility of the petroleum revenues in the general fund. And then the third component is the gap that isn't covered by petroleum revenues, isn't covered by the permanent fund, however you spend it, that is the gap that no one's plan is going to be able to close because the permanent fund's not big enough and our petroleum revenues aren't big enough. So whereas SB 114, like I said, annuitizes the earnings of the fund, we're doing both the earnings of the fund and the petroleum revenues to provide more stability than just annuitizing the fund earnings themselves. But as I said, under both of those plans, you're only going to get partway there, which leaves, you know, essentially it's up to the legislature whether you cut more, whether you increase revenues or your options.
So I hope I didn't break your cadence of rhythm there.
You didn't. So this slide three, is one that we've seen before, and I just wanted to cover a few thoughts about it. And what this slide shows is it shows the state's unrestricted budget graphed against unrestricted petroleum revenues. And not surprisingly, as these two numbers track each other very closely. When the government has a lot of money from petroleum revenues, when the state government does, it spends a lot more. When it has less, it has to find a way to spend less. And on a regression basis, the R-squared coefficient between the amount the government spends in its unrestricted budget and the amount of petroleum revenues that it collected in the prior year, there's a 0.83 R-squared coefficient, which is just a way of saying they're incredibly highly correlated. If we have more money, we spend more money. Now, this is true with the petroleum revenues, and it's true with the unrestricted budget. But I want to juxtapose that versus the permanent fund. Whereas the legislature, and probably most legislatures in commodity-based economies, are not particularly disciplined in saving petroleum revenues on an ad hoc basis year to year, the legislature and the state have been incredibly disciplined in terms of saving permanent fund earnings. We have a rules-based system around the permanent fund that's been in place for over 30 years. And the rule-based system basically does a couple things. It inflation-proofs the corpus, it pays out a dividend, and then there is a custom, not a legislative requirement, just a custom, of not appropriating the earnings reserve or otherwise taking money out of the system. So even though there hasn't been a particularly large amount of discipline in saving monies in high oil price environments, there has been an incredible amount of discipline in terms of how the legislature approaches the permanent fund. And in looking at this problem, one of the things we did is we asked, what was the difference? Why do we have incredible discipline on one hand in our savings, but we don't have a lot of discipline in terms of our year-to-year spending? And I think the answer is really the rules-based framework, that the legislature has shown a willingness and an ability and a desire to follow a structured rule-based framework, whereas when you don't have that rule-based framework in place, it's just, I think, the tendency to spend the money that you have available. So one of the goals is to not only reduce the volatility, but put around the petroleum revenues some rule-based frameworks that will increase the likelihood that that money is ultimately saved and spent on a plan rather than just year-to-year ad hoc. So the goal of the Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act is, if you look at 2015 or 2016 there on the graph, the goal is to take us off of the commodities roller coaster in terms of our governmental spending and turn this up and down herky-jerky spending pattern based on petroleum revenues into spending patterns that are stable. And this has several positive consequences. The first positive consequence is it certainly makes state budgeting easier if you know how much your revenues are going to be year to year, or the range of your revenues with some certainty. You know, in the past, we can have revenues go up and down 50%. You know, you went from ACES in 2008, which was almost $10 billion, to this year, which is we'd be lucky to get two. I mean, it's just very hard to run a government when you have that kind of variability in your revenues every year. So going to a more stable, annuitized system will make governmental budgeting easier. And that has the consequence of rolling through to our economy as well. One of the things that I mentioned last time I spoke was this paper by the International Monetary Fund that talked about the commodities roller coaster. And it was an analysis done of, I think it was 30 countries over 80 years, and essentially looked at commodity-based countries and asked the question, why do natural resource-based economies tend not to do as well? What's the limiting factor? And there were a couple of different factors. One was they tend not to have broad-based taxation, some of them don't, which makes you subject to that cyclicality of oil revenues. So what the paper ultimately suggested, and I think common sense shows, is that if you can find a way to take this very volatile commodity price-based revenue source, which in Alaska has historically been as much as 90% of our total revenues, if you can find a way to create a fiscal structure that isn't reliant year to year on that volatility, that it doesn't just make governmental budgeting easier, it will actually improve your economy as a whole. And that's because you want to avoid what the paper calls the danger of pro-cyclical spending, which is where you spend a lot when your economy is good because the government's flush with revenues.
What's your source, the paper?
The International Monetary Fund paper.
Okay.
So I just wondered if you were talking about the company paper there,
no.
The ADN.
No. The final thought is that, you know, we're trying to avoid pro-cyclical spending, which is you don't want to spend a lot of money when your economy is doing well and commodity prices are high at the cost of then not being able to spend money when your economy is doing badly at low oil prices. Because what happens in not just Alaska, but in many oil economies that don't have a sound fiscal structure, and you're seeing this all around the world in oil-producing economies that aren't diversified or don't have a sovereign wealth system that is designed to insulate it, what you have is you have, you know, oil prices are $110 a barrel, you have huge capital budgets, you have growth in your operating budgets, you know, a lot of social programs get created, and then oil prices come down, you burn through your short-term savings. Alaska's got pretty good short-term savings in the CBR. We're luckier than most. But at the end of the day, you're put into a situation where you reduce your capital budgets very low. Saudi Arabia's famous for high oil prices. They build everything, and then oil prices come down, and like construction just stops. So there's, you know, cranes still on buildings that never get finished. And you have to claw back your operating budget. You have to claw back services. You have to find a way to reduce the increase of costs that you developed when oil prices were high. So by coming up with a system that takes out the swings and the cyclicality of the volatility of oil prices, you don't just help the state budget, you actually help your economy. Because as Mr. Hoffbeck said, you know, governmental spending is one of really the two major components of the Alaska economy on a percentage basis. So having governmental spending come down dramatically at the same time that the other economic sector and the private sector of petroleum development comes down is kind of a double whammy for your economy. And at least in terms of the IMF, they came to the conclusion that for those oil-based and commodity-based economies that can kind of solve this problem, diversify their economy away from commodity prices, that over the long-term trend that could mean as much as, or an average of maybe, a 0.3% increase in annual GDP growth, which is a pretty big number. I mean, that compounds over time to a very large number. So that's a long way of saying that we ideally would be able to find a way to come up with a fiscal structure that shields us from oil price volatility. And like I said, the two ways to do that are broad-based taxation or it is using your sovereign wealth assets. And I don't think anyone here thinks we have an economy that is broad enough to tax at a level that would basically diversify us away from the oil and gas sector. They're just the major economic component. So that really does leave finding a way to use our sovereign wealth assets as, you know, the best option to develop sound fiscal policy.
Just go back to one of the rules you talked about. There's not a strict adherence. The Constitution requires 25% royalties for quite a while. The legislature and the administration supported a 50%, and the 23rd legislature that was reduced. So there, some rules are more flexible than others.
Yeah, Senator, that's correct. The savings, I call them the savings rule and the spending rule. The savings rule has had a little bit of variability in it, but I've always kind of thought of that as they were just doing a little extra, so I always kind of thought that was a good thing. But on the spending side of the rule, the legislature has been incredibly disciplined. They've never sort of broken the rules framework to, you know, raid the earnings reserve to build a capital project or something.
So, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Mr. Attorney General, this is a little bit off target of, but it's another element that I just ask you to think about, if not comment on. As you know, the state of Alaska, the state pays for everything. That's an overstatement, but it's not too far from the truth. And we haven't talked about that adjustment because we pay for everything. And we have the great expectation of coming out of this building, we'll pay for everything. And that's the other component that I think it's important for us to come to grips with. And that's a hard conversation because we pay for everything. So maybe for a later date.
Well, Senator Huggins, through the chair, this kind of goes back to what the chairman said in that for good or bad, any solution with the permanent fund is a half solution. So to the extent that, you know, we believe as a matter of policy we should cut spending, you know, we've still got that billion dollar differential under any plan. So that's going to involve, like I said, eventually either new revenues or spending reductions. So there's going to be lots of room for the policy discussions around those under any path forward with the permanent fund. So on to slide five, under our rules-based framework, and I think it's critical, and I actually gave a chart that I won't go over today, but I'd like everybody to take a look at it when they get a chance. Under the rules-based framework, we tried to think about how do we ensure that the permanent fund is sustainable. And we could have adopted multiple definitions, but the one we adopted was that we would preserve the purchasing power, the inflation-proofed value of the permanent fund over time, to ensure that the next generation has the same level of wealth, at least, that the current generation does in its savings. We also wanted to make sure that the earnings reserve was durable. That's necessary because we can't tap the corpus constitutionally. So if you're going to take draws out of the permanent fund to go to the general fund and to pay your dividends, you have to ensure that you have enough money, you have a high probability that you have enough money in the earnings reserve under your modeling to know that it doesn't come down to zero one year and you've been expecting that you'll have a couple billion dollars go to government and the money's not there. That would be obviously very problematic. And then the final item here is inflation proofing. We wanted to provide a mechanism for inflation proofing to make sure that the earnings reserve just didn't grow too large over time, because one of our protection rules is we want enough in the earnings reserve to sustainably fund our draws, but we don't want so much in there that it becomes, you know, it increases the chance of a raid in the future, essentially. So for that reason, it's generally, I think, good policy to take what you don't need in the earnings reserve and move it to the corpus.
So, Mr. Attorney General, you have you, you're an attorney, you think a lot about the words. Is that how the administration will characterize any appropriation from the earnings reserves as a rate, or is it an appropriation, or is it a legal expenditure? You've used that word multiple times, and I just want to know what you're framing.
So, Mr. Stoltz, Mr. Chairman, maybe I should frame it rather than a rate. I should frame it as ad hoc spending. That would be spending from the permanent fund in a manner that is not under a sustainable plan.
I just don't want your words to come back and bite you, or, I mean, unless they were just kind of careless words, but if they were calculated, certainly wanted that on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, second to last slide here is really this is where we get to sort of the comparison, I think, between different ways that we can handle some of the mechanisms. And what I was trying, or what we were trying to do here, is to show the difference between what we're calling the sovereign wealth fund model and a classical endowment model. And the difference being that in the sovereign wealth fund model, we're housing the petroleum revenues in the permanent fund itself. And under the classic endowment model, the volatility of those petroleum revenues remains in the general fund. And then the other side of the matrix is the options about, do you go with a fixed draw or do you go with the percentage of market value draw? And shortly, the advantage or the attempted advantage in the governor's bill where you house the volatility of the petroleum revenues in the permanent fund and you draw out a fixed amount, there's a couple of perceived advantages. One is that you're able to spend your petroleum revenues at a flat level based upon reasoned assumptions. So in lower years, you can spend a little bit more. And in higher years of petroleum revenues, you save a little bit more. So I think about it just like I think about the permanent fund itself, and I mentioned this earlier. We don't want a system where we spend permanent fund earnings every year based just upon earnings, right? Because some years the earnings could almost be zero. Some years they could be very high. So we find ways to smooth it or average it, or in this particular instance of SB 114, we do a percentage of the market value as a way to get, you know, a reasoned calculation as to what the earnings will be, but ones that don't jump all over the place. Putting the petroleum revenues in the permanent fund is a very similar concept. We kind of know likely in a broad range what they're going to be over time. So by putting them into the permanent fund, we can assign a value to them and spend a certain amount every year. And this is not only part of our plan, it's also sort of the Scott Goldsmith approach too, is think about your petroleum revenue as an asset and decide what amount of that asset you can spend every year on a sustained basis.
Senator Higgins.
So, Mr. Attorney General, under the endowment model, that's assuming that the permanent fund maintains its traditional role, right? We don't use it, right? It's not leveraged for something else.
Senator Higgins, through the chair. So in this case, I was thinking about it would maintain its traditional role, plus it would pay out something to the general fund so it wouldn't be the traditional role of the status quo. It would be the traditional role plus some kind of endowment-like payment to the general fund. So it would be payment to the general fund plus dividends.
Right. But if we took the permanent fund in its traditional role and decided that the state was going to use it as a backstop for a pipeline, a gas pipeline, would that destabilize the permanent fund, or would it create volatility, or how would you characterize that?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, so I don't know, because there's a number of ways you could do it. I mean, if you were going to do that, and I certainly haven't heard anyone propose that we do it, I mean, I think it would probably just look like a direct investment by the permanent fund itself in an investment, as opposed to the government using it to backstop bonds. But I suppose if you were going to do that, you would look at a number of different ways if the permanent fund wanted to do that. I mean, it would be their choice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You'll keep us updated if any of that thinking changes?
Sir, I will, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
So as we move to a percentage of market value draw and we move to an endowment model, which is a little bit more like what SB 114 looks like, whether or not you take a fixed amount or you take a percentage of market value, you know, both of those make sense and both of them are reasonable and both of them produce the same amount of money under time. It's just there's a little more fluctuation in the percentage of market value approach to just drawing $3.3 billion. So that's just asking the question of, do you want – the volatility of market returns, do you want that to reside more in the permanent fund or do you want it to reside in the budget? And if you do a percentage of market value draw as opposed to a fixed draw, then you have the volatility of the fund value fluctuations over time, they're resting more in the budget. Whereas if you just take out a fixed amount on an annuity calculation, that volatility resides in the permanent fund. But either approach is rational. What is the biggest difference between the governor's approach and the sovereign wealth model and SB 114 is, again, coming back to this idea of where is the oil price volatility going to reside. And the disadvantage of having it reside in the general fund is that you're really stuck with the amount you collect every year. You don't get to make reasoned assumptions about how much you can spend over time, which means you're going to always have that volatility in the general fund. You're going to have years where it's very low and very high. And that's what our next slide, and I think our last slide here shows, second to last slide. So this slide is a hypothetical exercise that was done a couple months ago by the Department of Revenue, and it basically says if we go back in time and we had enacted percentage of market value, and I believe they did 4.5% in 2002 or 2003, what would that have looked like? The blue bars are the unrestricted petroleum revenues the states collected each year. The yellow bars are what the PMOV payments would have been to the general fund after paying dividends. And what you see is a percentage of market value approach, it doesn't smooth the volatility curves associated with oil prices. Really what it does is it layers on additional revenues onto that volatility. So in low years, that makes a lot of sense because you need those revenues to sort of meet your budgeting needs. But in high years, the percentage of market value actually compounds your pro-cyclical spending problem if it's not adjusted, because you're putting your savings into a general fund that already has excess revenues. So this is the spending bill that the committee adopted in the committee substitute, the revenue limitation bill of the amendment today. It's a good amendment, because what it does is it says when you're at those high oil price environments, you're not going to put the yellow piece, you're not going to take it out of savings and put it into what is already a highly funded budget. The difference, though, between that revenue limit and what the governor's bill does is twofold. One is it doesn't provide for automatic savings of the petroleum revenues into a savings account at very high revenues. And it also doesn't allow you to, like I said, spend a constant level of petroleum revenues over time regardless of what you collected. So you are going to have that volatility in your general fund even under the revenue limit cap.
By not spending it, it increases the likelihood that will happen.
If yes, it does.
So you can't think about what you're doing with it if it's not there.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. For the portion that is the percentage of market value payout, it doesn't provide a limitation on spending or revenues in terms of excess oil revenues. So that's really the distinction, is the spending limit, or the revenue limit, does a very good job of making sure you don't spend financial savings when you don't need to, but it doesn't go to the next step of ensuring financial savings at really high oil prices. So I think that those were my major points. The last slide here is just a very brief discussion about the different dividend methodologies and just a few observations about those that I had. I think we all understand the earnings dividend approach. That's just the statutory net income approach that's used now. We've certainly heard a lot of testimony about the royalty dividends. I did want to offer an observation really about two combinations of dividends that I think maybe don't make the most sense, just when you get into the math. The first observation is that if you're using a percentage of market value draw, and I've written Senator Coghill a letter on this that I'd be happy to share with anyone, but if you're going to do a percentage of market value draw, it's a little dangerous to use an earnings-based dividend, because the percentage of market value is a pretty steady state amount. You know, it won't vary that much year to year, particularly if you calculate it on an average and a lag, but your earnings-based dividend is always going to be very variable. So if you're going to pay your dividend out of your PMOV draw, if you do an earnings-based dividend, you're essentially creating a bunch of variability in the dividend, which means you're creating a bunch of variability in what goes to the government every year after you subtract out the dividend. So I'm not sure that that's totally clear, but the consequence will be is that an earnings-based dividend, because it's so variable, it will result in making it harder to depend on the revenues to the general fund each year. So a preferred alternative, I think, to a PMOV draw on an earnings dividend is a PMOV draw and a PMOV-based dividend. You know, you can have the same value of the dividend over time, but if you base it on the market value of the fund rather than on the earnings of the fund year to year, then you don't get the variability and the swings that we have under the current system. And although variability and swings might be good policy for some reason in terms of people's dividend, it's hard to see how that variability in the actual funds that go to the general fund make a lot of sense, because you do want that stable revenue. And the other type of dividend combination that I find a little challenging just on the math is what we had in the initial version of SB 114, whereas if you have a royalty dividend and you have a floor, you're paying out of the system the upside of oil prices, but you're guaranteeing the downside of oil prices through the floor. So it just becomes very easy to get unsustainable very fast. So that would just be my observation. And other than to say thank you for the committee's patience and time and being very generous with your time, I hope you'll pass out our bill and we'll have the opportunity for further debate in future committees. Mr. Hoffbeck, do you have anything?
No, you don't have to hope. It will depart. If you can count three votes here, one of them will be mine to move it out. And I think your persuasive powers will get the other two. So, the only thing you can do is slow it down right now, Mr. Attorney General.
Well, in that case, I'll stop talking.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Well, I just wanted to say thank you on the record to Commissioner Hoffbeck and to Mr. Attorney General Greg Richards as well. The public doesn't often hear those stories or see the work that goes on behind the scenes between our branches of government on their behalf. And I just want to say thank you to both of you and your teams that have worked very closely with our team in our office. And we've shared numbers. We've tried to make sure that neither of us get blindsided or embarrassed when different information comes forward. And all good work on behalf of the people. And absolutely understand where this model comes from. And I'm looking forward to hearing the debate in the finance committees. Really appreciate this last slide, slide 8. That will give them certainly an opportunity to consider all of the different proposals that are out there and put forward. And what I think is fabulous about you guys having led on it and come forward is I now believe that something will happen. I absolutely believe that in both the House and the Senate. And I don't think it's going to look anything like mine or yours or Mike Hawker's, but I think that that something will happen. I think people understand where we are. They understand that, again, like a root canal, don't want to address it, but they're through the stages of grief and at that acceptance level. And so I just thank you for the work that you've done on behalf of the people.
There's things worse than a root canal, or hearing this, we could be talking about vitamin D3. But I want to acknowledge there's a lot of great attorneys that are working for the people. And you have one young attorney who really doesn't reflect her fewer years in practice, Ms. Polk. I've mispronounced her name several times. Ms. Pocan has been an incredible quiet worker on this legislation, and we're just lucky that young attorneys dedicate their career to public service and working for the people. So I chaired the law subcommittee and developed a deep appreciation. I still will tell an occasional lawyer joke, but I do them with a little more guilt now.
Nice.
With that, are there any other questions for the Senator Coghill?
I just want to make a comment because I think as people listen in on what's going on, this is the first committee that is going to go to the Finance Committee. But the real question is, can we use the wealth of the state to stabilize out our government as we start slimming down? To date, earnings of the permanent fund have not been used for the general government purposes. And if we just use the methodology that we're using now and took money out of the earnings reserve account and put it into government spending, then the dividend would be highly impacted because it goes into the formulation of the earnings reserve. And what we're trying to do is protect that as a value, both from your methodology and from 114's methodology. And I think that's a message that just continually needs to be said out loud, is it's a way of saying the wealth of the state needs to be valued to the state for the first time ever from the permanent fund, and how to share it both in government services and through dividend, and sustain it in a very healthy way. So I appreciate the approach that you all have taken, and that was my reason for putting in this little amendment, because it's a methodology change. If we don't do anything, we could still use, at a 21-11 vote, we could still use the earnings of the permanent fund, but the impact to the dividend would be great, and we haven't changed anything in the volatility of the state. So I just wanted to say that out loud for those who are listening in.
Thank you. Lastly, I'd like to recognize former Commissioner Corbis, who has the intense interest of a citizen of Alaska in this process. As Senator Huggins established, he's just here as Bill now, Alaskan concerned about the future of our state. And I appreciate your attendance at these proceedings and your past service for the state of Alaska and your continued services as an extraordinary citizen. And I don't think I could heap enough compliments on you, even if it makes you uncomfortable, but thank you, sir. And it's our intent to recess to a call of the chair. Mr. Brzezinski will be contacting your offices to see if we can get something much earlier than 7 p.m., and we'll let gavel to gavel, and we'll let the public know with as much advance as we can. And we may not be able to meet in this committee room, but we'll adapt to that. We'll find some place and a time and deal with the amendments, and it's our intent to move the bills out. Senator Wilikowski's bill, Senator McGuire's bill, and the governor's bill. So with that, we will stand in recess to a call of the chair. Senate State Affairs, come back to order after a recess to the call of chair. We have full membership of the committee here at 2:32 p.m. in the Betty Fahrenkamp committee room. And it is still the 15th of March. We have three measures to take up. We have SJR1, Senate Bill 114 with two pending amendments. One of them has been modified. There's a conceptual amendment to extend the sunset additional year, the Senator Coghill amendment, and then the Senate Bill 128. And so I think we're probably have fully debated the bills, and this will be mostly procedural motions of moving these little friends along. With that, first, we're going to bring up SGR1. Okay. Does everybody have that in front of them? Senator Wilikowski, would you? We've had public testimony, previously heard the bill. Would you like to move the bill out of committee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would move SGR1 out of committee with individual recommendations and any accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, it's moved out of committee with as so moved by Senator Wilikowski. Next we have up Senate Bill 114, Senator McGuire's bill. We have two amendments. I'm going to bring back amendment number one before us. I am going to move... I'm going to move the amendment and object. And
I will further move that we amend the amendment. It would become amendment number one to, I believe it was amendment number one, yeah,
right.
Which is a, I move the amendment to amendment number one, which consulting with the sponsor, she asked, Senator McGuire asked if we could extend the sunset additional year. I wasn't wed to any time period. This would extend it. It's a conceptual amendment. It would have taken too long to draft the complex sunset language. I think it's fairly understood what we're doing. We're adding an additional year to the sunset. So I move that amendment. Is there any objection to amendment number one to amendment number one? Hearing none, the amendment to the amendment is adopted. Is there anybody that had any questions about the sunset provision?
No, and I remove my objection.
Hearing the objection removed, is there any continued objection to amendment number one as amended? Hearing none, and it's adopted. Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to restate the amendment number two. There was a technical error in it. So on amendment number two, it was the drafting on it. I had it as a U.2 with Senator Mr. Kirshengardner. Ms. Kirshengardner. It's actually U.3, so I'd like to amend the motion to adopt amendment number two with that proper citation of U.3.
Is there...
Just object for explanation.
Sure. Senator, go ahead, Senator.
It was just exactly the same amendment. It's just that when they typed it up, they had the citation as a U.2 rather than a U.3. So it's just technical.
Is objection maintained?
No, I'm removed my objection.
Hearing none, amendment number two is adopted. Are there any other amendments? All right, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we move out of the Senate State Affairs Committee Senate Bill Sponsor Substitute for Senate Bill Number 114 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Are there any objections? No valedictory. That the bills move from committee. Next, our last measure before us is Senate Bill 128. Are there any amendments? Any additional discussion? Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move Senate Bill number 128 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 128 is moved from committee with individual recommendations. Isn't this a lot better than meeting at 7 at night?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the prodding of the committee. Is there any other business to come before the committee other than signing our reports?
I'm buying seafood tonight.
Nice.
Very good. Thank you. I'll leave the jokes to the colonel. Yeah. With that, hearing no other business before the committee, I wish the sponsors of all these measures Godspeed in their next deliberations. It's been a lot of fun, but all good things have to end. With that, we will stand in adjournment.